Welcome to Deft Decisions in Chaotic Conditions, How Experts Create Order from Turmoil, the thought-provoking series on how to set, align, and implement priorities. Here's the host of our show, management consultant, speaker, educator, and president of Business Alignment Strategies, Pat Lynch.
Welcome. I am Pat Lynch. I have as my guest today Deputy Chief Mario Rueda of the Los Angeles Fire Department. Chief Rueda has 29 years with the fire department and is commander of the Bureau of Emergency Services. Chief Rueda oversees the fire department's 107 fire stations, which include 47 task forces, 53 single engines, 89 paramedic ambulances, 40 basic life support ambulances, 5 fire boats, 5 helicopters, and the Special Operations Division. During his tenure on the department, Chief Rueda has held nearly every rank through the rank of assistant chief and has worked in many of the most active areas in the fire department. His career has seen him command many of the emergencies that have impacted the city of Los Angeles. In addition to his responsibility of overseeing emergency services delivery for the fire department, Chief Rueda is active in state and national committees overseeing the development of safety and incident management system standards. Welcome, Chief Rueda.
Thank you.
I wanted to remind people the purpose of this interview is to get some insights into how to set priorities, how to ensure that they're aligned with those of the organization, and then make sure that they're implemented. So the first question I have for you, Chief Rueda, could you describe for us or tell us in what types of situation you find yourself setting priorities and kind of let us know the process that you use in order to do that, please?
Actually, a whole variety of situations that require the prioritization. Probably first and foremost, although it's a smallest percentage of my activities, it's probably the most important, and that is really dealing with the emergency operations. At the scene, I still do respond to emergencies when they get to circumstances, when they get to a major emergency, which is 16 fire companies, I actually get dispatched, and oftentimes will confirm the priorities that have been established by the previous incident commander, or in some circumstances find that priorities need to be adjusted, or sometimes we'll work with the ICs on setting some new priorities. That is one circumstance. I often work with the balance of the fire department's management team on setting priorities for other things away from emergencies, such as training and other initiatives that are being worked on in the department. I also work with staff, my own staff, the assistant chiefs, and the two assistant chiefs that I have working in my office, and the other staff on setting priorities for work, and really when working on establishing priorities, I quite often refer back to our operating principles in terms of what we're going to work on and how we're going to work on that. So, including that review of the mission statement, which tends to at least center me on what things we should be working on and what things should be take priority of resources.
Mm-hmm. And that's particularly important these days as budgets have been cut and people are kind of scrambling to say, what do we do now?
I agree.
Let me go back, if I may, to something you said when you were talking about responding to a major emergency. You mentioned that there is an incident commander, and you also mentioned that sometimes, depending on the situation, there may be new priorities established. Could you speak a little bit, please, about who determines whether the priorities need to change, whether there's a process to do that, or how exactly is that handled, please?
In the fire service, I think most fire agencies actually work on the premise that the first individual and then first company officer and then first command officer would each take command of that incident, formal command, as they arrive on scene. Initially, it's generally a captain, and he would be followed by, if the incident continues to escalate, he would be followed by a general. In most agencies, it's a battalion chief, and like our agency, he would be our first command officer to arrive. And really, all of our battalion chiefs would be expected to run that incident through to completion, but they may require some help because of size, scope, complexity, or other circumstances. But generally, that first arriving captain and then battalion chief would establish the incident priorities. And generally, they are the preservation of life, making sure that we do save lives. And secondarily, we do try to preserve property. And third, we would really try to stabilize the incident and provide for recovery. And those are general priorities that we apply to every incident. Now, with that, each commander is also responsible for implementing our risk management policies. And that really determines the requisite strategy that would be applied to whatever the problem happens to be. While preservation of life and property are really the first two priorities, that would have to be consistent with risk management, our risk management policies, which are really if there is no lives to save and no real property to save, there really shouldn't be any risk to the responders.
Okay.
Secondarily, if there is no lives, but there is some property that can be saved, commanders can take reasonable risks to try to preserve somebody's business or home, but really shouldn't be engaged in high-risk evolutions given that there's no lives at stake. Now, in the circumstances of lives at stake, then our commanders can really engage in high-risk evolutions to ensure that lives are saved. For example, this past year we've had actually several major events that faced the city of Los Angeles. The one noteworthy that comes to mind is the Metrolink train accident. Now, the first arriving firefighters encountered a fire because of the spilled diesel fuel. Dozens of injured, walking wounded, along with a number of people that needed many victims that were actually entrapped in the train cars. The first arriving companies actually weren't fully aware of what the train manifest was, because one of the trains was a passenger train, the second train was actually a freight train. So they weren't completely aware of what was contained in the freight train, and in that case, that first in battalion chief did understand, I have lives at risk, people that need to be extricated. Although I do have a fire and I do have a lot of unknowns, the train cars were unstable at that point, not shored up, but he deployed firefighters into very precarious positions with rescue tools in order to start extricating patients, not knowing the full extent of that, of the hazards of that circumstance. And that would be one of those situations where lives at stake, our company officers and our battalion chiefs can really take the greatest risks when they know there's lives to be saved.
And that was quite an incident. I think probably the entire city and surrounding area were, you know, people were just riveted on their, you know, to the television watching this as it unfolded. And as you pointed out, there were many unknowns. And I think that's a great example of the fact that even though you do advance planning, when you get to an emergency situation, you really don't know oftentimes what you face.
precisely that train, although it did end up containing frozen strawberries, which was the cargo, we really never know what the cargo is crisscrossing our city or coming into our port or flying into, you know, our airport, so or running around in tanker cars along our freeways. So the firefighters, you know, they do train, and certainly a train accident isn't anything that we would consider completely unknown or a crisis where we haven't thought about that. But the magnitude of that event was something that was somewhat novel to our folks, because even in my 29 years of experience on the department, I have never seen that many critical patients at one event. Mm-hmm. Probably in the magnitude of 40 to 45 patients that were actually immediate, which are critical patients, needed to get to emergency rooms and operating tables right away. And that was one of those circumstances where we had a battalion chief that initiated those priorities based on his situational assessment of his initial situational assessment. Then he has an assistant chief that actually comes in. That assistant chief makes his own assessment, reviews the strategy and the deployment and the organization that has been put in place by the battalion chief. And in this circumstance, I arrived about 35 minutes into that incident. And as it developed, I saw several things that needed to be addressed, and we did so through deployment of additional resources, additional supervision and organization, and then also started to focus the command staff on recovery and really the victim issues, which because the primary focus of the initial response was really rescue and getting people to hospitals, as it appropriately should be, but As we do get more resources and we do get additional command staff, we can start to address additional issues, which we did.
Yes, that was quite an operation. As you say, it was just the numbers involved and the uncertainty and also the risk that the firefighters were taking. And it seems that you also needed some specialized equipment brought in, and that was really quite an event.
Yes, really one of the things that we learned from the Glendale train crash back in 2003, I think it was the distribution of patients to trauma centers around our region really does help to save lives. They do have surgeons on staff and staffs that are prepared to receive critical patients, and we probably underutilized aircraft in the 2003 accident, where in this accident we actually used all of our aircraft in the city of Los Angeles, our air ambulances, five of them, and we also relied on support from the Los Angeles County Fire Department and the sheriffs to also, through mutual aid, support us with their air ambulances, which in many cases I think absolutely saved lives. There was very critical patients on the ground, and 30 minutes later we're in operating rooms at UCLA and other various trauma centers. So it really did save lives. I touched initially on additional or setting priorities and how each successive level of command comes in and may change priorities or add additional priorities. One of the things that occurred at the train wreck was when I arrived on scene, I did put command organization in place and also started to request resources as part of our incident management team to come in and really start to look at the subsequent operational periods for both resources and support, and also to reassess our priorities as the rescue portion of the incident starts to diminish. Then other priorities start to come to come to the forefront, such as taking care of the victims' families, trying to reunite some of those individuals that were not critically injured but did walk away from that incident, starting to support that center that we had set up, also working with the coroner on extrication of deceased individuals, working with the NTSB on investigative issues and supporting that effort. So there's a variety of priorities that are competing, but through proper management and setting of priorities, those things can work in concert and actually ultimately, I always feel the better we manage and the better we lead, we're actually doing a better job for the public.
And that, you've actually raised several points. I'm taking notes here that I'd like to come back to. Let's start with this idea, actually a couple of ideas. One has to do with planning, because obviously there has to have been a lot of thought that went into the setting of the priorities and then how they unfold. You talked about the learning afterwards, for example, from the Glendale train accident, the things that you learned that you then were able to apply to the Metrolink. And I'd also, if you could kind of bring them in, you talked about the collaboration. You have a mutual aid agreement with other agencies. And, you know, once you start bringing other people, other equipment in, there's more complexity. And so, you know, how do you work with all of those things to have the outcomes that you'd like to have, please?
In one of the unique aspects is actually in California and in this region here of Southern California, there's a very well lubricated sharing of resources. We actually work with the adjacent fire departments quite frequently on events, and actually in the areas of our specialized resources, like we used in this case, urban search and rescue and air operations, are both very well versed in the practices and the tactics utilized by various agencies, and they're nearly identical, which is also helpful. But we have agreements with Los Angeles County Fire Department for exchange of resources, and actually for wildland fires, we exchange resources on initial dispatch, which really helps to integrate the two agencies with respect to air operations, understanding each other's tactics, communications, and understanding the hierarchy of command. So most of those issues are actually rehearsed and trained and practiced and fairly seamless. Although their helicopters are a different color, they work in a fashion that if they were all painted the same color, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And similarly with our urban search and rescue resources, they train together. They are both involved in federal programs that deal with urban search and rescue as a part of FEMA. So they are also similarly situated in that operation and that training, and actually deployment in this situation was really seamless. So those agreements that we have with, in this case, Ventura County and Los Angeles County, actually worth their weight in gold, because they did provide additional resources as we needed during the incident.
So how, you know, as you're developing these relationships, which are so important, as you've noted, how is it, and I'm thinking of this in terms of people who are listening and wondering, okay, so we're talking about actually implementing the priorities. How are those set in the first place? And I understand you said, you know, your priorities are first, you know, preservation of life, second, preservation of property, and third, to stabilize and provide for recovery. You know, within that, is there a process that you use, or, you know, just how does that How do you identify the criteria by which you then set your priorities?
As I stated, the priorities for all firefighters really across the nation really are that preservation of life first and then property. The process by which a commander would go about doing this, or really what we teach our commanders to do, is really to first and foremost, as much as they can, try and understand the problem. And really that's part of that situational assessment that they make as they arrive on scene, the reports they get from initial arriving officers or firefighters, any information that may have been received at dispatch, their knowledge of the area, the specific area, and any potential hazards that they may be aware of in a certain area, or certain quirks to a district that they may be aware of. Firefighters spend quite a bit of time and effort making sure they understand the geography of their areas that they're assigned to, and also the hazards that target hazards, different kinds of occupancies, buildings, accessibility issues. So really all that weighs into a officer's situational assessment of a problem, because there may be dozens and dozens of considerations that go through an officer's mind if he were to really take the time and try to catalog them, but all this is taking place in the matter of seconds as they arrive on scene of an incident. And that also includes at least a mental review of some of our policies that are also in place with respect to incident response. So all this takes place in that initial situational assessment, and it's really part of what we call in the fire service the size up.
Okay.
It's really sizing up that problem. What is the problem I'm dealing with? The size, the scope, how complex is this? And then in the fire service, we also, it's thought that's where that experience comes in. Because if somebody does have a previous experience somehow related to this type of event, they start to catalog that and at least start to come up with potential solutions for the problem based on that experience or training or, you know, policy that we may have. The second part of that process is really determining what are those things that need to be done. What are those things that immediately need to be done to preserve life? And secondarily, what are those immediate things that need to be done to preserve property? And that may be setting up some sort of containment, making sure the problem doesn't spread, whether that's keeping a fire from spreading or containing, keeping some kind of product from spreading, or whatever the problem happens to be, not letting it get worse. So that's part of all that determining what the objectives are. In most circumstances, because firefighters do have experience and our command officers are experienced, this is all taking place in a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
As they size up the problem, they know immediately these are the things that need to be done, and this isn't necessarily a very formal process. The next step of that would be really to communicate to the various resources or firefighters their deployment, meaning which people are going to do which tasks that were determined in the objectives that need to get done. For example, somebody may be putting out the fire. Somebody may be treating the patient. Somebody may be removing the smoke. Somebody may be having to perform rescue. And these are all generally conducted simultaneously. The next step generally for a command officer would be to really look at some sort of organization to make sure that there's really appropriate supervision and a span of control, appropriate span of control. As incidents escalate, they do tend to can sometimes overwhelm our commanders. What we found in the fire services is about 5 to 7 is an appropriate span of control, and generally our incident commanders would look to provide some sort of organization to make sure that the span of control doesn't exceed that, so that the radio doesn't either get too jammed up or too many informational inputs for the incident commander to deal with. And and really that cycle continues as an incident goes on. So as he puts an organization in place, he may reassess, redevelop those objectives that need to take place, make sure it's still consistent with an appropriate strategy, meaning there's not too much risk associated with the activities, and deploy resources, make sure the organization's okay, and continue through that cycle through an incident. And that's really what happens as incidents escalate and get more complex and get larger. The planning staff for an incident would really be going through this same process. Whether it's the smallest incident or the largest incident, they're really going through this process of continually reevaluating and going through this cycle to make sure that things are covered and that the incident still matches up with the plan that we've developed.
Right. So it sounds like certainly the training that you talked about earlier as being one of the initiatives that you oversee, as well as the experience, really become critical factors, so that when the responders go in, it's almost rote or habit because they have been so well trained. And in the down times, they're developing capacity and they're continuing to develop and to really hone their skills just for times like this.
Exactly. I think I could state that for the most part, our incidents, majority of our incidents that we do respond to are part of that mental catalog that we have of experiences that allow an incident commander to really go through those steps that I discussed in really milliseconds, because I've seen the thing, I know it, I know what to do, I know where things, I know the appropriate strategy, deployment, and what organization fits. But we also, one of the reasons we also teach this is I believe that really as the fire service, the role of the fire service, we are the only agency that is there 24 hours a day. We never close, and we really respond to any call from the public for any problem. Mm-hmm. At least in the city of Los Angeles, I find that the fire department gets called out to a variety of incidents that really don't, or at least don't fit the traditional mission profile. Mm-hmm. And I have found that our fire chiefs and our officers, our captains, are very, very good at going through this process of sizing up what the problem is, no matter what it is, and developing things that need to be done, an appropriate risk strategy. If there's other agencies that need to be involved, bring them into this process and come to solutions for the city. I have found a variety of incidents that have occurred here in the city where fire department, not being the primary the traditional response agency, has had a significant role because of our ability to respond and organize and bring folks together. We had early in my career, I saw one of the first instances of this when we had a portion of the street in Hollywood, on Hollywood Boulevard, actually start to collapse, and it was during the construction of the subway that was in Hollywood, and a variety of agencies responded because we have they saw the potential for building collapses and the street going in Hollywood, and oh my gosh, what are we going to do? And I saw our commanders back then go through this process, and we certainly don't have a book or a policy or a training manual that says this is what you do for a giant sinkhole in the middle of the city. But as the fire department command staff got there, went through this process of bringing people together, getting enough situational assessment to start determining what things needed to be done, and then started to work with the agencies on deploying, you know, appropriate steps to help to mitigate the problem. So I find that the more value that this fire department brings to the city, the more that we will be seen as a value, and will gain the support of the public and the elected officials.
Right, right. And I think, you know, the point that you just made, I think, is really, really important, and that is it's all about process. Because you don't know all the facts. In fact, you probably seldom know the facts when people come up on an incident. And so if you relied on a policy or you looked for something in a book, it's not there, number one. Number two, you can't take the time to do that. So you really need to train people to the process as opposed to, let's use this tool or this method, and that doesn't work.
I think it actually ends up being a combination of both.
Mm-hmm.
Because the next event may be something none of us has ever seen before, and that really is where the incident commander is going to be challenged to really be thoughtful about really what are the true problems here. Conversely, we have, for example, we had a 250 square mile fire here in the Southern California area, the station fire earlier this year, which we participated in, although the city was only touched upon about a 4 mile border. But the station fire really left a significant mud and debris flow potential for a whole variety of foothill cities, including our own. So one of the things that we did post-fire was start to work with the public agencies to help to define really what our problem is here in the city in terms of our potential exposure for mud and debris. But also we went through a series of training classes for our captains and our chief officers so that they're at least familiar with the hazards and the potential and the resources that we would require in the event of significant rainfalls and mud and debris flow and structure collapses, so that they at least do have that formal training that they can refer back to in the event that they're called to one of these situations. They do at least have some basis of knowledge, and they combine that with their with their process and their thinking, mm-hmm. and they can come to the right solutions for really provide that better product to the public.
Right. Well, let me ask you one more question, and that is, how would you use your experience in setting priorities and being flexible and realigning as necessary back in the office? And again, given that we're dealing with budgets that are just a fraction of what they used to be. The economic downturn has caused furloughs, layoffs, early retirement in the city of Los Angeles. How can you translate? How might people use some of these lessons in that type of situation?
Well, I do find there are a few parallels, but quite candidly, some of the skill sets that prove helpful in an emergency can sometimes be detrimental in the in the office in that most of our work here in running the fire department budgets and staffing and personnel and those issues are really not as time sensitive and really do deserve the merit of a full vetting of the situation. That really is that one piece that I do think translates very well is really developing that good situational assessment of the problems that you may be trying to solve before you jump in and solve something that may not necessarily be the right problem. And then the second piece that I've also found is really capitalizing on the number of folks that may have viewpoints that may be the answer to the problem you're searching for, as opposed to closing off those or not taking the time to really develop the input. Really looking to use the wisdom of a crowd, so to speak, meaning getting more input to develop a better solution. Because I do find in the office environment, when we do have time, that really does prove to help people get on board. You at least hear all the elements of the pros and cons of a direction. And then can feel comforted at least moving forward when you do have to move forward with difficult circumstances, and that okay, at least I've seen all the elements of this problem, and I'm comfortable with or uncomfortable, but at least I know why I'm uncomfortable with a certain direction.
Right, and sometimes that's what it takes. And when you have that level of comfort with discomfort, if you will, then perhaps that helps make better decisions as well.
I agree, and it also tends to at least, not that you're not listening, but it tends to make people feel they are part of the process. And I do think I have come to learn that that's an important part of really moving forward with things that aren't necessarily the easiest things to move forward with, as you've discussed, which are budgets and layoffs and different ways of doing business. So I do find, I have learned that I don't think people so much mind change. I think sometimes they mind more being changed. And it's a subtle distinction, but it's just that taking the time sometimes to develop processes for input and also giving some thought to how strategically, like in this 4,000 person organization, communicating some of those ideas in a fashion that people understand, as opposed to putting something out and not having thought about how it's going to be communicated, and then end up doing damage control or working twice as hard to correct some misnomer or misnotion about an initiative.
Yes. Well, thank you. I so appreciate your sharing your expertise with us today. We've been talking with Deputy Chief Mario Rueda. He is commander of the Bureau of Emergency Services for the City of Los Angeles Fire Department. And to all of you listening, thank you for being with us. I wish you all the best. My name is Pat Lynch. Have a great day.
We hope you enjoyed this edition of Deft Decisions in Chaotic Conditions, How Experts Create Order from Turmoil, brought to you by Business Alignment Strategies. If you would like to learn how you can ensure that your organization's people, programs, and processes are aligned with its goals, contact us at www.businessalignmentstrategies.com.